years ago, we threw ourselves, our cares into the wind headlong. And years ago, our nights, they carried on deep into the dawn. Restless in our time, couldn't even recognize it then for what it was. It was a sure sign, couldn't even recognize it then for what it was. And years ago, we threw ourselves, our cares into the wind headlong. And years ago, our nights, they carried on deep into the dawn.
This is Vinylthon. All vinyl, all day.
Because when the needle drops, the power rises.
Welcome to the Vinylthon 2026 Station Simulcast, a self-syndicated one-hour program where we'll talk with great artists in the Vinylthon universe about the joy of record collecting and listening to vinyl and collecting music. I'm Brad Savage in Akron, Ohio, at the Summit FM in Akron, Canton, Youngstown, and Athens, Ohio. And in this next hour, we'll be speaking with members of Flatland Cavalry, Josh Ritter, UK sensation Declan McKenna. Plus, Derek Wood speaks with Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. And Peter Creighton will talk with this year's Vinylthon ambassadors, Cheekface. This is Vinylthon, and we'll get started with an affirmation from Dave Mustaine.
This is Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. Welcome to Vinylthon. If I was forced to pick my top three vinyl albums, I would probably pick some old classics because of the tonality of the instruments back then and a lot of the analog amplifiers, as well as the analog consoles and analog recording devices. Same thing with the analog microphones. So probably the White Album from the Beatles. Probably Wish You Were Here from from Pink Floyd, or The Dark Side of the Moon, which is another great album for sounds like that. And most definitely, because it's very personal to me, AC/DC, Let There Be Rock. And again, like I said, to me, all of the analog equipment, the chain, the series of all of the parts, all being as much analog as possible, to me, had a really warm sound. And of course, you needed to have a great stereo and playback system to make it all come together. But if you were that critical about all those parts in the series, then you already had a great sounding stereo.
That's Dave Mustaine of Megadeth, and this is Vinylthon 2026. Now, a brief discussion with the gentlemen of Flatland Cavalry, a great band in the West Texas Red Dirt Sound based out of Lubbock, Texas. And recently, I spoke to them about collecting records. Are you guys record collectors? You get into old vinyl and everything.
Yes, yeah. We got a collection at home.
Nice. Sure. What are some of the things, some of the artists or classic recordings you really enjoy?
Stardust by Willie Nelson is one of my favorites. I have a country Christmas album that I was spinning during Christmas. Just perfect. Some old, you know, $3 record that you find somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Collection of a bunch of different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Reed?
One of my favorites is a Jim Croce record that I have. That was a classic.
What songs are on it?
Operators on that
one.
Oh,
nice. Oh, yeah, perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
How about when your stuff comes out on vinyl? Like, what is that feeling like when you actually hold your album on, like, a physical LP?
It's really awesome, and I always like the sound of vinyl. It's, like, warmer sounding. Yeah. I personally enjoy it more than any other way to listen to it.
And to get the vinyl and hold it in your hands, it going from an idea in your brain and your heart to this, you know, tangible thing, not this digital streaming, you know, apparatus that's floating around the air. It's like that you're holding on to this, you know, your life's work, and it's a beautiful feeling.
Flatland Cavalry on Vinylthon. This station is participating in Vinylthon and raising money for college radio student scholarships for young broadcasters. Find out more at Vinylthon.com.
This is Vinylthon.
I like vinyl because I like being able to say that I have a physical copy of the album and I feel like I'm supporting the artist more.
Vinyl is good, so celebrate with us.
Vinylthon. Because when the needle drops, the power rises.
Next, we check in with Vinylthon contributor and correspondent Derek Wood of 88.9 WRDL Ashland University in Ashland, Ohio. This is a special interview with Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad.
On April 10th, 1970, the Beatles officially disbanded. On July 4th, 1970, Casey Kasem hosted the original American Top 40 countdown on the radio for the first time. By the middle of the 1970s, the average price of gas was 57 cents per gallon, and the average home cost $37,000. Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter were all in the White House during the decade. The most popular movie of the 1970s was Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. Meanwhile, the music scene was evolving, and rock and roll was in high demand. Some of the most popular groups of the day included the Eagles, Aerosmith, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Boston, Styx, and Grand Funk Railroad, among many others. The latter group saw 19 songs on Billboard's Hot 100, including 8 top 40 hits and 2 number ones. The group sold over 30 million records worldwide, including more than a dozen gold and platinum certified albums. I'm Derek Wood, general manager and faculty advisor of Ashland University's award-winning student-run radio station, 88.9 WRDL, and the world headquarters of Nice People, Ashland, Ohio. As part of Vinylthon on WRDL, I spoke with Mark Farner, founding member of that group from Flint, Michigan, Grand Funk Railroad.
I'd like to go chronologically and kind of start with some of your earliest, you know, memories of music and playing music and some of your influences, and then kind of build out from there. So if you could think back to being a child, what playing music and your biggest influences, what were some things in music that guided you that became this influential and impressive career?
The main thing is the music, of course. And early on in my childhood, I remember 3 and 4 years old, and we had a jam session. My mother moved to Flint, Michigan from Leechville, Arkansas, when she was 16 years old. She met my dad. They got married, had us kids, and every Sunday, man, at that farmhouse or my Aunt Dorothy's house, we'd have these jam sessions. And then, you know, the fiddle, banjo, guitars. My dad played guitar and blue saxophone, and all the women sang. And when the women would start singing, Derek, oh, my God. It was like listening to angels. You know, there's something about family harmony, those family voices blending together. And it was so good. It really put the hook in me. When I started playing football, you know, I was defensive linebacker over center, the roving reporter. I was in on almost every tackle, man, because you know why? I loved to hear my name called out on the loud speaker, dude. They go, "That was Farner, number 66, in on a tackle." Oh, man, I got to get in on them tackles on some of them guys. Say my name on the loudspeaker again. But I got hurt scrimmaging the varsity team. The doctor says, "No more football. You can't be running track this fall." You know, so my mother felt sorry for me, got me guitar lessons. She got me 6 guitar lessons, and she rented an acoustic guitar. The strings were about that far away from the neck. You could have used it for a bow and arrow, that guitar, you know. But I learned how to play after 3 lessons because the guitar teacher shot himself in the foot with a 12-gauge and called my mother and said, "I can't teach Mark anymore. I'm going to be in recovery. You know, I shot myself in the foot." Wow. And I learned how to play keyboard by playing Virginia Atherton's keyboard that she had. It was like a church organ that she had in her living room. And I said, Mrs. Atherton, can I try playing that organ? I just like to. She said, sure, Mark. And she showed me how to turn it on. She says, you know, go for it. Nobody's playing that thing. You can play it. So anyway, I taught myself how to play Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs. I liked playing because I was really into dancing, and I liked the music that made me want to dance.
You know, your career now is almost 60 years back to the late 60s. Terry Knight and the Pack, is that the first band you were in, or is there little bands after learning how to play the guitar before 69? Are there bands in between before you're with Terry Knight?
My first band that I was in was Mojo and the Nightwalkers. You had four microphones, three guitars, and dude, it was cool. We thought it was the best thing since white sliced bread, you know, serious. And then we moved on from Mojo and the Nightwalkers to the Derelicts. And then Robin's Hoods. And I think it was out of that I went and played with Dick Wagner's Bossman. And the Bossman was a show band that I had been watching, you know, since I was just a young musician. I loved them because they were very entertaining. And Dick, of course, was the guitar player for Alice Cooper. And he wrote Only Women Bleed. He wrote a bunch of great songs, Wagner did. And he asked me if I wanted to come and play rhythm guitar with those guys. I said, yeah, man, I would love to. So I'm playing rhythm guitar with Wagner. And one night after a gig, we played the Lakeland Castle up in Lake Huron Shoreline in Michigan. And we went back to Saginaw, and we're sitting there playing our electric guitars, but not plugged in because his wife and kids were sleeping in the other rooms. So we're out there, and he's showing me some chord inversions. And I said, it came to me just out of the blue, Derek. I said, how do you write all of these songs? Where do all these songs come from, dude? And he reaches over and he touches me. He points right to my heart. He says, they're right in there, Farner. He says, you got them in there. You can write music. I said, I can write music? He said, yeah, man, they are in you. He goes to bed, you know, and I stayed up. And I wrote my first song that night because I had somebody that had enough confidence in me, Derek, to tell me I could write songs. And when he reached over and touched me there, it was like, wow. He stuck the key in the lock and turned it the right way. Because that song that I wrote, my first song, was Heartbreaker from the first Grand Funk album. I wrote it when I was 18 and recorded it when I was 20. And it's a big song, man. We still have it in the set these days.
You're riding the success of Closer to Home, a multi-platinum album, in June of 1970. By 1971, there's an article that comes out in 71, August of 71, a Rolling Stone article. It's a month after the Shea Stadium show, which we'll talk about in a moment. But by that point, you guys have six concerts a week for 7 weeks in a row. Is it just literally grueling, or is it what you've talked about with you're wanting to make people dance, you feel this energy? Is it exciting every night, or does it get grueling just being on the road that much?
Actually, we have the energy for it. And the only thing it was really tough on was my voice. Because, man, I was singing way up, you know, singing Inside Looking Out and songs like that night after night after night after night. And sometimes, man, it would feel like, oh, my God, am I going to be able to sing tonight? And somehow, dude, we pulled it off, sang them every night.
July of 71, Shea Stadium. You sell out Shea Stadium in 72 hours, faster than the Beatles. It's become this kind of synonymous thing with Grand Funk's meteoric rise. Just a few years into your career, what about that experience is so memorable all these years later?
Prior to Shea Stadium, we had done a European tour. Humble Pie opened that European tour. And we loved those guys, loved hanging with them. They were a wonderful bunch buddies. You know, we were friends. And I said to Terry Knight, dude, we need to bring Humble Pie back to the United States and open for us there. They deserve to get heard in America. And he talked to D. Anthony, who was their manager. They actually opened for us at Shea Stadium. They were the opening act. And the people loved them. New York loved them. And what a great place to start in the United States. That was our friends. We felt like, man, this was the right place to be, the right time. And from that point on, being that it was a record-breaking night, you know, the fire marshal almost shut it down because of the flexing of the stands were flexing. And when we flew over in the helicopter, I looked out the side door and I could see Shea Stadium bouncing to the rhythm of Humble Pie. The stage was set up at second base, a semicircle, Shea Stadium. Dude, they were rocking it. They were warming that audience up, and they did very good on their own. Too bad Frampton split away from them, but it is what it is. He's a great guy, but those guys together, Humble Pie, man.
Two number one hits, We're an American Band and Locomotion. What's it like to be atop the music world twice?
I think it was due. You know, we had the numbers way before then, as far as attendance, audience attendance, sold out Shea Stadium before any number one hit singles. We had the hearts of the people with us. When Shea Stadium sold out, Derek, there was no Ticketron or any of this stuff online. There was no such thing as online. In 71, you had to go to the ticket office at Shea and buy your tickets there. $4, $5, and $6. That was the ticket price. $4, $5, and $6. Compare that to today.
Something like college radio is truly one of the last bastions of hope and music being presented to audiences and being able to go down memory lane and play Grand Funk, but then also play a new act that's trying to emerge on the scene, and nobody's paying any price to hear that. It's free radio.
Absolutely, brother. And I'm going to tell you something. What you're talking about today and the questions you've asked and the people who have listened today, they have gotten an education maybe beyond what they were stuck with. And now maybe they are a little deeper. And now maybe our movement, our rock community, because we do have a community, brother. There are a bunch of music lovers who are part of our community that want to use it for good, that want to use it to commune in love, in relationship, in freedom, man, that don't want the takeover. I applaud you. You know, the radio station that you're at, I know because I talked to a few other college stations, you're doing the best from your position right there where you're at. Better than anybody who's trapped by a mainstream, you can't do this list. You can't say this list. You can't mention this person. There's all these no-nos, and you can't even be a jock, dude. You and I are talking about real stuff here. And it's a pleasure to know that we're doing something good today. And I bet if your audience could honk their horns right now.
That'd be great. We get to hear it. Yeah,
yeah, dude.
Final few things here for you since it's Vinylthon. I wanted to ask you about what your favorite vinyl records are.
Well, Janis Joplin did like a live vinyl. It's the one where she's got those round glasses on and she got that Cheshire cat grin on her face. And she did a song by Howard Tate. And I didn't know that she even knew about Howard Tate because he's the guy I patterned my vocal style after. I wanted to sing like Howard Tate because he expressed himself and you could actually visualize, you could feel his character. So That is one of my favorite albums. Get It While You Can by Howard Tate. Electric Ladyland, Jimi Hendrix. The English pressing. It was a very different, wonderfully sharp vinyl record. You know, the cover spoke loud to me. And Fresh Cream, man. Fresh Cream, holy crap. We wore that thing out. Vanilla Fudge, forget about it. You know, we wore that out. Get It While You Can, Howard Tate. Man, I wore that thing out. I went and got another one. It was on Atlantic, Atco Records.
And finally, if you had to pick five Grand Funk songs that you think are the premier five to introduce somebody to your songwriting ability, your guitar playing, your showmanship, your frontman abilities, what would those five Grand Funk songs be?
I'd have to say I'm Your Captain would be the number one. This is tough. Heartbreaker, number two. I Come Tumbling, E Pluribus Funk. Creepin', Flip Side of American Band single. And Sin's a Good Man's Brother.
I genuinely appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and go down this trip down memory lane and do a little retrospective on your career and Grand Funk success. And it's going to mean a lot to a lot of people and supporting Vinylthon. It's celebrated by 200 radio stations nationwide and around the world. So I think it's going to be something very special for all those stations to hear. A celebrity synonymous with a wonderful decade in vinyl records, 70s rock and roll.
Yeah, man. Thank you. I appreciate it, Derek. It's been good talking to you, brother. And it's good to know that you have the depth of knowledge and the appreciation. It's wonderful that you do. You have it. I mean, it's pouring out of you, dude. God bless you, man. I appreciate your questions today. I appreciate where you're coming from in your heart and your motivation, man, to keep it alive. I'm with you 150%. Hi, I'm Mark Farner, founding member of Grand Funk Railroad, and you're listening to Vinylthon on College Radio.
She's some kind of wonderful. She's some kind of wonderful. Yes, she is.
This is the 2026 Vinylthon simulcast among 230 participating stations. Find out more at vinylthon.com. Still to come, Vinylthon ambassadors this year, Cheekface, plus Declan McKenna. Thanks for being a part of Vinylthon.
You are listening to Vinylthon, Vinylthon, Vinylthon.
Because in vinyl, we trust.
I'm Brad Savage from WAPS, the Summit FM, in Akron, Canton, and Youngstown, and Athens, Ohio. And recently, we had a station visit from Josh Ritter. We talked about collecting vinyl and the spirit of recorded music and physical music. Josh Ritter joins us now. So are you a record collector, LPs and vintage records and stuff?
You know, I the way the records have always changed my life. LPs have been a part of my life since the beginning. And, you know, at first is the only medium I heard the music through, you know, and then as discoveries, you know. And I am a firm believer that the music comes to you and any art comes to you and you discover it in whatever format. It is pure and there's nothing like just dropping the needle on a record, you know.
Well, and the artwork too, you know, as opposed to a computer file,
and just the sensory, the intention, the ritual of playing a record, that one side, and you know, oh man, I used to go to sleep at night listening to After the Gold Rush, and I would always try to go to sleep right before Southern Man would come on, because the Southern Man had the most amazing like guitar stuff and would wake me right up. But if I could fall asleep right before that, you know, that's
yes, that's the same with my 9-year-old. We do Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon as a bedtime record, but he tries to be asleep by the time Time comes on because of the clock sound.
That's right.
It wakes
that's right.
him up. Up next on Vinylthon, let's meet this year's 2026 Vinylthon ambassadors with Peter Creighton of WXAV in Chicago. we meet Cheekface.
Hi, this is Peter Creighton from WXAV 88.3 FM Chicago, and I am so happy because I am able to sit down here with this year's Vinylthon Ambassadors for 2026. They are America's local band. They're America's favorite local band. They are Cheekface, and we have the entire band with us. We have Greg. How are you, Greg?
What's up? Hello, Vinylthon listeners.
We also have Amanda with us. How are you, Amanda?
Hello, doing good. Happy to be here.
And last but not least, we have Mark as well. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Awesome, awesome. Guys, thank you so much for being here and supporting Vinylthon. I think because, you know, this is for Vinylthon, we have to kind of go with some vinyl questions to kick us off. So, you know, we feel that vinyl and college radio, you know, they're like a hand into a glove. You know, it's the best way to listen to music and everything. You have the community aspect, and then you just have the richness of vinyl. So I'm curious, what are some albums for you that you recommend to people that they have to listen to on vinyl?
Ooh, someone else go first.
I can go. One of my favorite albums to listen to on vinyl is Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. I think you need to listen to that on vinyl.
I totally agree with you and Amanda. And what's really cool is I have that on vinyl, but I have my mom's copy of that. Mm-hmm. So a really good sentimental tie with it. But yeah, the harmonies, love it too. Great choice.
Yeah, it has a really warm sound on vinyl that you can't get on any other way of listening to it.
Yeah, I'll piggyback off of that, both on the like sentimental parental thing and the sound quality. My record, I got it right here, Townes Van Zandt, Live at the Old Quarter, Houston, Texas. My dad gave me this. I had never listened to it before, and it's like it's become a huge favorite, and like really like a lot of the songs mean a lot to me and just like remind me of my dad. And then also it's like it does not sound very good. Like, you know, it's like a lot of the record is like the guy who's like hosting the nights that Townes Van Zandt's performing is like talking about like, sorry, the air conditioning's broken. And you can kind of like hear people like making noise, like eating and drinking in the background. And even at one point, Townes is like, I've never heard it so quiet in here. And then I feel like kind of like, you know, the warm, like less like bright of listening to it on vinyl. You're like, yes, this is, I feel like I'm there. Doing this like unique kind of not perfect. I don't know. It just works for me. So
I love it.
I'm going to say, I mean, there's so many where I pull them off the shelf, like where I'm just like, I'm going to put on the record player and I can't wait to grab this one off the shelf. One of them is definitely Swiss Movement by Les McCann and Eddie Harris, which is a Live at Montreux album from 1969. It has a really awesome version of Compared to What on it. I think there's a great take of Cold Duck Time on there as well. And it's just one of those records where with what the kind of music is and the type of performance and probably the process of recording it at that time, like it just all really gels when you put it on the record player. And it was also for me, it was like a dollar bin find. Like it was like had a cut corner from like being a promotional copy or something. So I was like Les McCann, Eddie Harris, that's Compared to What, it'll probably be good. That's probably one of my most listened to pieces of vinyl ever, you know, and we love a dollar bin record.
Yeah, we do love a dollar bin record. It's the thrill of the hunt, really, of just finding that treasure in that. But no, I love the variety and everything. So many of the stations participating in Vinylthon are college radio stations from not only across the country, but from really all over the world. What has college radio meant for Cheekface?
Yeah, I mean, I was a college radio DJ when I went to school. I went to UCLA and did college radio for all 4 years that I was there. I started it right away. Even before I went to college, like I had a friend who had an overnight show on the closest college station to where I grew up, which was KUCI in Orange County. And so we'd go overnight and play stuff and also like One thing is they had like a large metal barrel that they used to put up like DJ turntable setups on, and then they'd roll it away when they didn't need it anymore. So we just turned the mics on in the middle of the night and hit the large metal barrel. And, you know, having like a classic college radio moment, I would say. And yeah, I mean, you know, I was a philosophy major, but I skipped a lot of philosophy classes. But I never skipped a radio show. Like, I was always, you know, rocking my time slot, whatever time that was, you know, whether it was 2 to 6 a.m. or like, you know, whatever. And yeah, I think for me, like, college radio is a lot of the sound of what I think a good song sounds like, is the kind where like you can't wait to push play on it, because as a DJ, you're going to hear it and also your audience is going to hear it. And so that's like, you know, just I always think of songs like that, like, oh, is this a song I both can't wait to play and can't wait to share out to like a faceless audience that I don't see, but I know they're going to hear it through their speakers, and it'll be like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. Like, what a surprise. It's so catchy. I've never heard of this band before. It's weird. It's off the beaten path. It's not the kind of thing that most of my friends would like, but that's why I'm listening to this station, is because that's the kind of music that I like. I don't know. That's why I think like college radio is so special, and we're, you know, so grateful. We get a ton of support from non-commercial stations, from both college stations and other non-com stations. Like, we, proportional to how popular of a band we actually are in the world, like, you know, the amount of like love we get from non-com stations is extremely heartening, because there's just so much of it. You know, I think like part of that is like we grew up listening to that kind of subtype of weird music that's like not just off the beaten path, but like off the path that's off the beaten path. And, you know, and so that's the kind of music we like to make. And it's awesome that it resonates with the non-com radio community of DJs and listeners.
I think that's awesome that you mentioned that, because I've actually been playing you guys on my show for about a year now, which is crazy that I'm able to like say that to you. But Pete calls me the station's cheek freak. Like, that's the title over here.
It is.
Every station has at least one. Some stations are made up completely out of.
Yeah, we're working on converting him. So
no, convert it.
My main question is based on the fact that I saw you guys last year when you came to Chicago. It was my graduation present. There was a moment during that show that my friends and I still talk about, like, on a semi-regular basis, just because of how funny it was. You guys played Noodles 3 times in a row. When did you start playing it multiple times in a row? And what's the most times you've ever played it in a row?
Okay, so we started doing it, I want to say, in 2024, like halfway through our touring in 2024. And, you know, when you're on tour, you're in a van, you're living with your friends, like, you're eating gas station snacks for most of your calories. Your mental well-being, I'm not going to say it decays, but it starts to fray a little bit at the edges. And I can't remember if it was me or someone else who was just like, what if we play Noodles twice tonight? And then everyone else laughed. And then I was like, we're doing it. Screw it. Let's give it a try. And then, like, you know, the first we did it the one time, and then like people absolutely tripped when we played it twice in a row. And then that we were like, well, that went over pretty good. Like, maybe we do it 3 times tonight. And everyone was like, yeah, that makes sense. And then it was 3 times. And then it kind of by the end of that tour in 2024, I think like the most we did it in one show was maybe 6 times.
So from what I remember is like, in the van, we're kind of like betting, like, how many times this do you think we can play it in this next city? It's like, I was always like, no, we got to play it less. We got to play it less. And then I think we ended up playing it like 9 times at one point. And I was like, okay. That's
like, I mean, yeah, there were definitely some that I can remember. And, you know, Setlist FM probably will give you the full story of the Noodles repeat saga. But yeah, there's definitely some like end of tour shows, like where we were doing it like 4 or 5 times in a row in the middle of the set. And then we get to like, we don't do an encore, like, cause we think encores are kind of pretentious and annoying. So like we would just like get towards the end of the set and say like, thank you. Like, we're going to wrap up now. Thank you guys for coming. And then we just do it some more times. Yeah. and that, like, again, like, does it make sense? Like, in general, maybe not, but like when you're in your tour brain of like subsisting on nothing but like almond sleeves from the gas station, it does, it makes sense. And then, you know, it's kind of stuck as a tradition. Although we try not to, I mean, you know, you have a limited time when you play a show. Everyone who's working at the venue, they just want to go home at the end of the night. So do we want to keep them there for another 9 minutes of noodles? Like, I don't know if we like always want to do that every night, but for the right special occasion.
Yeah. I think we landed on 3 for like the next tour as the like magic number.
This last year's tour, we did 3, we did 3 per set. I think maybe 1 or 2, we did 4 because we were feeling frisky.
I love that. I want to say it was 3 when we saw you, and like the second time was like, oh, they're doing it again. The third time was the one where we were like, what's happening right now?
It's definitely fun to watch the audience reaction from the stage. Like, you get pretty used to normal, you know, you have people clapping, like there's like, you play a song and people react a certain way. There's something about the repeats of Noodles specifically that elicits a really unique reaction from the crowd. So it's like, it's really fun for us to get to see that too, because it's not a normal reaction.
Yeah, there's definitely a like, you start to understand how our brains work the second time you hear it. And then the third time you hear it, your brain starts to work that way.
It did. It actually did. We listened to it in the car on the way home, I think, twice. I was like, I think I'm experiencing what it's like in your heads.
So some really great news has come out. You guys have a new album coming out later on this year. It's called Podium. And a couple singles have dropped from it. Came out today. It's Black Sight. And man, you guys do not pull any punches at all with Black Sight and everything. Can you kind of share with us your approach to writing this song?
Yeah, I think like the first... we'll usually start with a groove first. And I think like the groove we were sort of vibing on was Black and White by the DBs, which is like such a college radio classic. Although I wouldn't say the songs sound that similar, but it certainly were like, and I think that opening lyric of just like, I, and then there's a big space, like is also how that song starts. So I think that is probably a direct intentional ripoff. But yeah, I think, you know, part of the writing process for me and Mandy has always been like, you know, we are living in this world. It's weird. It's sick. It's sad. It's disgusting. It's also funny. Sometimes how sad you are about it is funny that you'll be that sad about it. So I think like, you know, we like to write a political song because we are all living in a political world and it feels weird to write songs that aren't political. We sometimes do write songs that aren't political, but not that much because it feels just disingenuous not to acknowledge the incredibly obvious things that we are all seeing and experiencing together in like our weird, sick, decaying, angry, violent society. So, yeah, I think that's like, you know, where that came from. And yeah, I think like, you know, we were chuckling at the I got Seoul, but I'm not Korea, 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 Korea thing, which like, I mean, obviously it kind of crosses over to college radio bands in Pavement and The Killers. Mm-hmm. But like also mentioning Korea as like, you know, that's Korea is the echo, the country of the two countries of Korea are kind of an echo of a past American military adventure that like never ended. Like the Korean War has not been officially brought to a close and the United States is still heavily involved there 75 years later. So, you know, I think I think if you're very young, you see the Iran War and you're like, what is happening? If you're a little older, you're like, I can't believe we're doing the Iraq War again, which was the era of the CIA black sites that are referenced in the song. If you're a little older than that, you're like, I can't believe we're doing a second Iraq War after we just did one. and so on and so on backwards. And like remembering backwards far enough, one will get to the Korea War, which like now there aren't many who were alive when it started. And yet it continues to be an American foreign military excursion. So, you know, I think all of those, like, I think, yeah, that's like some of the connecting tissues. But also, I mean, that lyric was just fun to sing. And as we like auditioned it on the song in the practice space, we were like, that's pretty fun, huh? Maybe we just, yeah.
Repeat it. We're all about repetition.
Yeah.
Just like the United States military's foreign adventures.
Exactly.
So, like, one of my favorite things about you guys is that you are a political band, but not in a way that's horribly depressing. Because I feel like it's really easy to get bummed out about stuff, but I like laughing at it more, and that's why I love your guys' music. And my question for you is it harder to do that now than it was when you started Cheekface? Because I feel like the world has gotten a lot darker since then.
I don't think it's gotten harder. I feel like, if anything, it's easier. I think as far as like our music and the lyrics that Greg and I are writing, they're a little bit more pointed. They're more clearly political than they were before. But I think the vibe when we started, it was because Trump got elected, and we were so confused by that and had no idea where to put our confusion and anger. And so we decided to write music. And the idea that Trump got elected was funny to us, you know. It's led us here, you know, where we're still kind of, it's a different kind of exhaustion, I guess. And it comes out in that cheeky way.
Yeah, I think when you talk about the challenge of it, one thing that I think of is we have a song called You Always Want to Bomb the Middle East. And it, like, you know, experiences a new surge in kind of popularity every so often for reasons that are just totally obvious. And, you know, when we wrote it, that title I got because I was watching a PBS segment about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. And there was like some intelligence analyst who was saying, you know, of course, the U.S. is withdrawing from Afghanistan, but we'll always have a presence there. We'll always have, you know, air power there. We have our military bases there. We'll have our drones there. Like, you know, so we're like, we're leaving, but we're not really leaving. We'll always be there. And I was just like, this guy always wants to bomb the Middle East, huh? And then I was like, wait, like, this, my whole life has been like bombing the Middle East. And then I started to like metabolize that thought. And you know, that line ended up in my notes. And then as we were writing a batch of songs, we felt really strongly that was one of our favorites. And so we like booked a studio day to record just that song. We were just like, okay, this song is so good. It's so timely. It says something we really want to say. Like, let's record it right now and get it out right away. And then in between finishing the recording and releasing the song, the Russian military started bombing Ukraine, which is like a proxy war that the United States is involved in. And so I was like, I think we were all like, well, this is like kind of a sensitive moment to put a song that like, it is kind of, it's funny in a black humor type of way. Like, maybe it's not the time to use humor as our tool. And we put the song, we shelved the song and we buried it at the back of that album as like track 9 or something, because we were like, well, like, let's not call too much attention to this because we don't want it to feel glib. Like, we don't want it to be a single right now while this sensitive thing is happening. And then, you know, lo and behold, like, there were soon more American military adventures in the Middle East after the song came out. And that song continues to like live its life as people are attempting to process it. Like, we were attempting to process it as we were writing the song. The song is mid process, right? I don't think the song presents you with a thesis or a resolution or a solution. I think the song is just like, ah, all of this input is coming in. I feel really bad about it. It's so bleak. And how can we paint that bleak picture without it just, you know, being like, war is bad, war is bad, Trump is bad, Trump is bad. And to, you know, kind of connect it to the various political and social threads that, you know, continue this cycle in our society, in our country, and globally as well. I would say, like, yeah, that's like one of the difficulties with the songs is like, we don't want to seem glib, but then I think about the other songs that I like in this like genre of very black humor, political songs, like I think of, Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag by Country Joe and the Fish, RIP Country Joe, who just died.
Yeah.
But like the song, you know, the song is it's a joke song that sounds like it was recorded at a carnival about the Vietnam draft. And recorded by draft age musicians for a draft age audience. And like, it's completely a silly song, even though its humor is gallows humor. And I think I look back to that and I'm like, well, that was like the bleakest time for the artists in a bleak place and an audience in a bleak place. And they can look at that and just be like, a funny song tells you something about this. Like, yes, Where Have All the Flowers Gone also tells you something about this, but Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag is also tells you something about this and helps you metabolize it and understand it.
I think you're really hitting on something that we don't necessarily think about all the time. And that's really like the power of humor in music. And I think that's what you as a band do so, so well is you can take this really serious material that's going on in the world today and you can crack a joke about it. And they always say laughter is the best medicine. Would you say humor then is the best way for you as a band then to kind of just process all the horribleness then that's going around?
It's part of it, I would say. It's not all of it. I think like all three of us are pretty like reserved people. We're not like the class clown style people. But we love a witty joke. You know, we need something to break the seriousness, you know? Like, <Yeah. laughs> and that's kind of where I think the three of us have come together. We all agree with each other politically. We like, you know, everything gets really kind of dark in our heads. And that we need that outlet. And that outlet is a safe outlet when there is some humor there.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, you know, playing with music with your friends is fun. And I think that the natural fun that we have, like playing music together as friends, like gets wrapped into like the attitude of the songs, but also like music that's funny is good music. Indie rock which is our genre, has moved away from things that are funny, but it's not because there were never funny things in the genre. There used to be lots of funny bands in the genre. You know, I think like in this era, there's been like kind of a change towards like, well, indie rock is supposed to be serious music. It's supposed to be sad music. And it's supposed to be like, it's supposed to be written by a single auteur with a acoustic guitar or a piano and a bottle of hard liquor and, you know, plumbing their deepest, worst personal traumas. And I think that like, I love music like that. Like some of my favorite artists are artists who do only that. But when it comes to like what's fun for us to do as a band, as a group of people doing something together, it's fun for us to do something that's fun to play, that's fun to make. That's where like we'll play it live and people will have fun listening to it, moshing to it, singing along to it, whatever.
That's fantastic. We're here with Cheekface here on Vinylthon. And to kind of change, you know, topics a little bit, you guys have such a special relationship with your fans. I mean, you guys interact with them. They're cheek freaks. I mean, there's this great little community that you guys have been able to really build around the country and everything, around your music and the fans and things like that. I mean, for you guys, what do the fans mean to you?
It's hard to like speak on this without sounding like a total cliche, but like the fans are definitely the coolest part of the whole thing. And obviously, like, as Greg was just saying, like, we make the music because we love making music and we're good friends. I think we'd be doing it regardless, but like without a doubt, the band big picture would not exist without the fans. And so it's like, I feel like a lot of times people ask us like, oh, well, like how do you go about getting like a Discord that's like good, like yours? And it's like, I don't know. That is 100% on the fans, the people who have found the music and then found each other through it. So yeah, it's like, it's so special. It feels so unique. And yeah, it's probably the coolest part of the whole project is the community that's found itself around it.
Yeah, I would say the Cheek Freaks are an amazing community. You don't think that you're starting a community when you start a band. You think you're writing some songs and recording them, and then you're playing in terrible bars for nobody while the ice machine rattles. And it's been cool, but I also think at first it was shocking, and now I think about it as a fan myself of other underground music, where I'm like, when I go to a show for certain artists, I'm like, everyone in here has something in common with me. And that characteristic is not very common in society in general. Like my mom doesn't know this artist. My sister doesn't know this artist. My cousins don't know this artist. I do. And these other people here, they know it too. And something about this connects with this small group of people. So, you know, I think there is something to that where whether you're at the show in a room with us or you're in the online community on the Discord or just in the chat on the questions box on Insta stories or whatever it might be, you know, you're like, oh, like these people have something really unusual in common with them. And that's a cool thing to bind us together. And I think, in society in general, we are all looking for smaller communities. Like we all have very big communities we're a part of and very loosely, like we have like, oh, I have this political allegiance and I, you know, and I'm have a relationship with everybody who has that, you know, and like in America, that's like 150 million people have your political allegiance. Maybe you're like, you know, belong to some faith group and, you know, there's millions of people who share this faith with you. And maybe you're a fan of some really big artist and that artist has a big fan base and you're like, okay, I share something in common with these millions and millions of people. But I think like our closest relationships is people, you know, they form with the people who have like this, the tightest, most unusual things in common with us. And whether that's like the people in your pottery class or, you know, your weaving class, or they're the people who like this weird underground band that you love, you know, we're all looking for those like smaller communities where it's a human level, the like interaction between people.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add, like with weird music, right? Like music that is not acceptable to the general public. When Greg and I started writing, that is where we really connected. I think like we liked these bands that were just weird and they weren't necessarily grouped together in any way. Like, and so it was just kind of like a mixture of like Jonathan Richman and Ween, like who, you know, and both Greg and I are like, yeah, we freaking love them. Like, how do we make bands like that? You know, and it's just like when you have those interests together, you might be very different people and you might have different styles or whatever, but like somehow you get that weirdness and that weirdness like is your connection. And I think that's a strong connection.
That was awesome.
Happy to be one of those bands.
Yeah. Yeah. I've definitely met people because of your music that have just been like the same flavor of weird as me. And I really, really love that. So side note, thank you guys for that.
You're welcome. Wear your Cheek Face shirt so you can find your friends.
That actually is a really good segue into my next question, because I almost wore my Support Your Local Band shirt today.
Hey.
Find it. But,
oh no.
I know, I'm about to go home and like tear my room apart. My favorite thing is that you guys call yourself America's Local Band. So how did you come up with that and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I haphazardly tweeted out just a random thought, which was like, after the pandemic, will there still be local bands? I think we all know what a local band is, even though it doesn't have a definition. But like, just, you know, to try to define it, like, it's a band where like they don't really break out of the hometown scene, but you see them a lot. Maybe they're opening everybody else's show. Maybe they're opening shows for big bands at the, you know, bigger venue, but like they're not the kind of band that like really has their own fans. They have friends from the scene who kind of support them, whether the music is good or not really. And they're like kind of flawed in a way where you're like, well, anyone can understand why this will never be popular. And here in LA, where we're based, like there was a huge community for that before the pandemic. Like there's a lot of bars, there's a lot of clubs, there's a lot of venues, like, and you know, day in and day out, those places were open, and you know, four or five local bands were playing there every night. Of course, the pandemic just put an extremely hard stop to that. Like all of a sudden, like the 20, 30, 40 venues that had four or five local bands playing every night, so like hundreds of local band sets a week around town were just like all stopped. And you know, we saw a lot of those bands break up. And then also in the meantime, during the pandemic, the world flattened, and all of a sudden, like the weird music from the internet just became everyone's weird music. Like that just became, there was no space for a zillion local bands. There was space for one weird band that we all talk about for a few days. And like, maybe we talk about them again in a month, or maybe we just never talk about them again. And so that was why I was thinking, like, will there still be local bands after the pandemic? And right before the pandemic shuttered everything was when we had just started touring and just discovered, like, after playing 30, 40, 50 local shows in LA to nobody, that in other cities where we'd never played before, there were a bunch of people waiting to see us. We were like, whoa, like, this is crazy. And there was, I guess, like a little feeling of like, will we be the last local band standing? Because we were like just kind of tipping between like being just a local band in LA and like being a band that was like going to tour and play in other places. Like before we had considered that we would be like a touring act that was on the road headlining every year, taking other bands we like to open for us and stuff like that. So yeah, I kind of started to feel like, well, the way the world has flattened, like maybe we'll be the last local band. Maybe we'll be America's local band. And then I think like I tweeted that follow up to like, will there still be local bands after the pandemic? And everyone was like, oh, you are America's local band. And then I was like, okay. And then we made a shirt. People bought the shirt. And, you know, so it goes.
The rest is history. Well, Greg, Amanda, and Mark from Cheekface, America's local band, and this year's Vinylthon ambassadors. Guys, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for having us.
The support of the college radio stations, the non-commercial stations, just, it really means a lot for us, like coming from that world ourselves. And you know, also being vinyl nerds who press a lot of vinyl and having fans who like to have cool vinyl, you know, we're so chuffed to be invited to be the ambassadors for this year's Vinylthon. So thank you so much for having us.
We just sent Podium out to the vinyl pressers. So that was like two days ago.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. I got to ask, any fun colors or designs for the album?
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Nice.
I'm really excited to see it once it's done. Yeah.
The crew from WXAV in Chicago speaking with Cheekface, this year's 2026 Vinylthon ambassadors. And that's Peter Creighton, who is a Vinylthon board member and College Radio Day board member as well. It's the Vinylthon simulcast for 2026. And up next, a brief discussion with UK sensation Declan McKenna about collecting records.
I do, yeah.
And when did you start? Like, has it been with you your whole life? Did you start in the CD era, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think I started with CDs when I was younger. That was mostly what we listened to. We kind of got iTunes when I was younger, but then, yeah, as I got older, we got a record player. And I really like collecting vinyls, particularly like secondhand.
Sure.
You know, I like to buy new albums when they come out, of course, but I love, you know, searching through old secondhand stores and finding old gems. Graceland by Paul Simon I found for a fiver when I was like 14, 15. That was one of the first really great ones that I found. And
pretty cool. Yeah. And there's something about the artwork, right? And the liner notes and all of that.
Yeah, it just looks really cool on the shelf, and the whole, you know, ritual of it is a beautiful thing. So it makes you slow down and listen to music rather than sort of having it in the background.
That's Declan McKenna as we wrap up this year's Vinylthon self-syndicated simulcast special. Thanks to all of our guests here, as well as Vinylthon sponsors, Button Punks, DJX, DJ Life Magazine, Glowtronics, sponsors of the Golden and Diamond Slip Mat Awards, and Live 365, along with Whiz Bang Bam, booking and management. Vinylthon.com to make your contribution to the college radio scholarships and to find out more. I'm Brad Savage in the Rubber City, Akron, Ohio, USA, for Vinylthon.com.
Hi, this is Gabriel Minchero, General Manager of Frecuencia Sam in Mexico and President of World College Radio Day. I'm excited to announce that registration is now open. Join us on Friday, October 2nd, as we celebrate this global event under the theme Hope Always in the Air. Let's come together to amplify student voices and the power of college radio worldwide. Happy Vinylthon!
You're listening to Vinylthon.
Heard on radio stations around the world.
Because in vinyl, we trust.
The Department of Veterans Affairs is so innovative, it not only improves the lives of veterans, it transforms the lives of healthcare professionals who serve them with access to the latest technologies and remarkable benefits. Transform your future at vacareers.va.gov.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the WONI Weekly Update. Here's some upcoming events to look forward to. On Wednesday, April 15th, celebrate Red's Mascot Madness Championship win in the quad from 2 to 4 p.m. Also on Wednesday, watch the women's lacrosse game versus Buffalo State at the Red Dragon Field at 4 p.m. Also happening at 4 p.m., watch both the men's and women's tennis team play Delhi at the Oneonta Tennis Courts. The Project Space Gallery has a new student-curated group exhibition called Change is the Only Constant.